This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode Bravo was recorded way back in June of 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. Our usual numbered Macro Voices episodes bring you timely market information each week. We cover the topics of the day, and we strive to keep the content as fresh and up-to-date with current market events as possible. The reason you're listening to episode Bravo rather than a numbered episode is either because it's a holiday week and we're enjoying the holiday with our families, or something went wrong, such as a featured guest canceling on us at the last minute. One way or another, we had to roll with our timeless backup episode this week, so unfortunately, we can't cover this week's action in global markets.
And I'm Aaron Chan. For our first timeless episode, which aired back on July 7th of 2016, we gave listeners a preview of the first episode in a four-part series Eric's been working on called Accredited Investor Academy. Today, we're previewing the second episode, so it's going to be Eric and myself this week, with no feature interview guest. Eric, please tell our listeners what the second episode in your AIA series is about and what they can expect this week.
Well, the whole idea behind Accredited Investor Academy is to teach entrepreneurs and others coming into wealth about the special categories of investments that are only open to accredited investors, with an emphasis on not being taken to the cleaners by the sharks on Wall Street. This content is designed for high net worth individuals, but my hope is that our retail audience will find it informative as well. But since our regular listeners are used to a different format, I want to be clear so people know what to expect. This week's show consists of Aaron interviewing me on the subject of what's involved in reinventing oneself from entrepreneur to making a career of managing your own money as a private investor. If you're a high net worth individual or an entrepreneur expecting to come into wealth in the next few years, this show has your name on it. It's all about how to become a sophisticated private investor. But for the veteran finance pros in the audience who come here every week to hear commentary about current markets or our feature interview with high-profile expert guests, sorry guys, we just can't do that this particular week. So please tune in next week when we'll be back to our usual numbered episode format. And please forgive the references you're going to hear to part 3 and 4 of this series. Frankly, they don't exist yet, and you won't really find them at macrovoices.com, even though you may hear us say that you can. We're airing this preview of part 2 in part because we're still trying to gauge how much demand there really is for part 3 and 4. I sincerely hope that you'll enjoy this second part in the series. You can find a preview of part 1 in Macro Voices episode Alpha, which aired on July 7th, 2016.
Folks, I strongly encourage you to stay tuned. We can't cover current market topics this week, but I think you're really going to enjoy this special preview of Part 2 in Eric's Accredited Investor Academy. This was originally designed to air independent from the Macro Voices podcast, so it begins with a personal introduction from Eric.
Hi, I'm Eric Townsend. In this second installment of a four-part series, I'm going to talk about the process of reinventing oneself from running a company as an entrepreneur to managing the proceeds from selling your company as a part-time or full-time private investor. When I went through this transformation myself, I had no idea where to start. I began by reading textbooks used in master's degree programs in finance, and I even considered enrolling in a finance degree program myself. In hindsight, I'm very glad that I didn't. While such a degree might be a necessary prerequisite to getting a job on Wall Street, my considered opinion is that it's a complete and total waste of time if your goal is to learn to manage your own money on a professional level. So this episode will focus on what I think you do need to know and suggest how you might go about designing your own self-education curriculum. We'll also talk about the differences in needed skill sets between entrepreneurship and investing, different categories of private investors, how to network with other private investors, and finally, we'll discuss when it does and does not make sense to do some of the trading yourself, and even the reasons that you might eventually consider running money for others professionally.
And I'm Aaron Chan, your co-host for the series. Eric, let's start with the differences between entrepreneurship and investing, and particularly with regard to the skills successful entrepreneurs usually possess and how they apply to the job of managing one's own investments.
Well, this is absolutely critical to understand because the skills of a successful entrepreneur and those of a successful investor are almost opposite in a lot of respects. Think about what entrepreneurs are good at. We're able to see clearly what other people can't. In my case, at the age of 19, I could see that the way people were designing information systems in corporate IT environments didn't make sense. They needed to embrace network computing. I could see that when nobody else saw it, and that enabled me to have a vision other people didn't have. Successful entrepreneurs, though, are people who know how to make things happen and get things done. There are a lot of other smart guys that had the same ideas that I did. I was good at making things happen and getting things done. We're also good at ignoring the people who don't get it. In my case, for my whole career, I remember meeting with customers and other people who would tell me, oh, well, the primary systems of record in a financial institution will always be on the IBM mainframe platform on the CICS transaction processing monitor. We would never consider any other platform. And I knew I'm dealing with people who basically just don't get it. They don't understand. They don't know how to think out of the box. You ignore those people. Well, when you think about what investing involves, unless you're going to be an activist investor like Carl Icahn who takes over companies and replaces their management, you don't get to make things happen and get things done. You don't have any control over things. What you have to do is wait and anticipate the actions of other people. You can't ignore stupid people who don't get it. You have to anticipate what stupid people are going to do because your job is no longer to ignore them and do something smarter. Your job is to predict what the actions of the mainstream are going to be because that's what's going to direct where the market goes. So you have to be in the what's going to happen business as opposed to the what should happen business. Entrepreneurs are usually very good at ignoring the traditional status quo about how things have been done in the past and focusing on a better way to do them that's obvious to us. That doesn't work in investing. You have to look at the way the rest of the world is doing things, and it can actually be a handicap sometimes. Frankly, I had a gift for being able to see 20 years into the future in terms of how information technology systems needed to be designed. Well, guess what? In investing, you don't want to be 20 years ahead of the market. It doesn't behoove you. You lose money that way. You want to be a couple of steps ahead of the market, not light years ahead of the market. So the skills of an entrepreneur and the skills of an investor are very different skills, and you're starting something completely new. Frankly, speaking from my own experience, there can be a big ego adjustment here. I was very, very good at what I did as an entrepreneur, and I was ready to be very, very good at investing from day one. Nobody is. You lose money at first. You want to start small and you want to recognize that you are taking on something new and different from what you have experience with.
Okay, so it sounds like you're saying even the most successful entrepreneurs will need to reskill themselves if they want to be successful as private investors. Now, Eric, you said earlier that with respect to re-educating yourself, reading grad school textbooks wasn't the right move in your experience. So what do you recommend to high net worth individuals who want to be successful private investors themselves?
Well, one of the first things I recommend, there are high net worth investor clubs. I was a member of one in New York City that had, you had to have $10 million of personal net worth in order to join the club. These can be very valuable. The idea is that it's peer networking with other private investors, and it's a chance to learn more about investing, investing in alternative investments, and things that are of interest to high net worth individuals. The thing I would say, though, and this is not a criticism of the club I was in, it was more the attitude of the members. The dues for these things can be tens of thousands of dollars a year, and a mistake that I made and that I observed a lot of other members making was you kind of come and show up and say, hey, I paid a lot of money for this. You know, deliver me my education on a silver platter. It doesn't work that way. All that these clubs give you is access to other people that are in your circumstances and to educational resources. You have to approach it as this is a hard job. You need to put a lot of energy into reskilling yourself. I would say that the process of becoming a full-time private investor is about the same as getting a master's degree. You've got to put that kind of energy into it, and nobody's going to make you do it. If you show up with the, hey, I'm a rich guy attitude, you're going to be a member of this club and you're not going to get anything out of it. Now, as far as the clubs are concerned, the particular one that I was in, I'm not even sure if they're around anymore, but frankly, I wouldn't feel comfortable recommending it. People that I met there who are no longer involved with that club are involved with an organization called IPI, Institute for Private Investors. They have a website at memberlink.net. Now, I've never been a member of this organization. I can't vouch for it personally, but people that I know and have respect for as private investors have spoken very highly about it. The most important thing, again, that I can tell you about these clubs is don't fall into the complacency trap of expecting that just being a member is going to produce results. All they give you is exposure to an environment and other people that you can learn from. You've got to take the initiative and take this seriously. Now, frankly, in the end, I probably learned more from listening to podcasts and reading books than I ever did from participating in the Rich Guy Club. But that's because I and a lot of my peers in the club were acting like it's a rich guy club as opposed to an opportunity to put hard work into learning something new, which is what you really need to focus on doing.
So joining an organization like IPI might be a good start, but I want to go back to the subject of reading books. You said that textbooks from finance degree programs were not the right place to start based on your experience. So, Eric, which books are you reading?
Well, I want to start with what I call the Schwager Doctrine, which I name after an author called Jack Schwager, who's written the most about it. And when he writes about this concept, he's really talking about trading as opposed to managing an investment portfolio as a private investor. But the point that he makes is you have to find the style of investing that matches your personality. There's a lot of different ways to skin a cat, and nobody is ever successful at just trying to find what's the right one. The right one is the one that matches your personality. My personal bias is macroeconomics, which means understanding what makes the world work by viewing interactions between nations and world events through the lens of economics and markets. So, to me, it's the most complex and interesting puzzle that's ever been defined in the world. And it's fascinating because you're very in touch with what makes the world work. So as an example of what really I find interesting, you know, there was a few years ago, there was this volcano in Iceland that's blowing up, or scientists were predicting that it was about to blow up. Well, to see something like that in the news, first of all, I find this kind of thing fascinating. I think science is really cool stuff. But to look at that and say, wait a minute, think like a pilot. I'm a very experienced pilot and flight instructor, so I think in three dimensions about this thing. They're talking about millions and millions of tons of volcanic ash being thrown into the jet stream with polar northerlies. What's downwind from that? Well, what's downwind from that is the Russian wheat crop. So as soon as I saw that news, I started buying wheat futures on speculation that if this Iceland volcano actually blew up, it was going to decimate the Russian wheat crop. It turned out the thing never blew up, but I still made money on the trade because other people were speculating the same way. I find that style of investing to be absolutely fascinating. Now, I met other people at this club that I was in who had the exact opposite orientation. I remember one guy who had spent an entire career working for a mutual fund that did nothing but invest in municipal bonds. And he had figured out that these large buyers and sellers of municipal bonds always followed a certain protocol and a certain procedure. And he could tell from market action, from price action, when somebody was starting a curriculum of buying a large position. And he knew how to front run it and get ahead of them just by observing what was going on in the market. And he would say to me, Eric, you're doing it the hard way. You're trying to understand the entire global economy and what makes it work. And why don't you just find one thing to be really good at? Well, that was really good advice. And it took me a couple of years to figure it out. And the answer, why do I continue to do it? What he quite accurately described as the hard way. Well, it's because my passion is understanding what makes the world work. It's just a part of my personality. So the Schwager Doctrine means figure out what style of investing is going to keep you passionate and keep you engaged. Because frankly, if you're a multimillionaire listening to this, you don't have to work. You're only going to stay engaged. You're only going to do a good job if you can find something that you enjoy, that you're passionate about. And I would say, for sure, be ready for some surprises. A lot of things that I never saw coming have become passionate interests of mine. A fantastic way to get started on this, Jack Schwager wrote four books called Market Wizards. Now, these are really for traders. It's about learning about how to actually trade stocks or commodities or whatever you're going to trade yourself. That may not be the right move for a private investor. You may be better off to be what I call an asset allocator and let other people do the trading. But I still recommend these books. If you read these four books in the series, a lot of it won't make sense to you if you don't have a finance background, but it doesn't matter. What happened for me is I'm reading stories about different managers and how they manage money, and I'm just thinking, I don't even know what these guys are talking about. Then I would read a story from somebody like Jim Rogers, and I'm like, wow, I love the way this guy thinks. So I recommend that you identify maybe who are your role models of investing. And by role models, I don't mean the most successful guy in the world. I mean the guy that you relate to. Jim Rogers was a role model for me. George Soros has become a role model for me. A lot of people with that style of investing are my role models. That doesn't mean they're going to be your role models. You might think like my friend in New York who just wants to focus on one very specific thing that he can learn to do better than anyone else.
So Eric, you mentioned surprises. Can you give us an example of what you're talking about?
Well, if you told me 10 years ago that I was going to become passionate about crude oil, I would have told you you're nuts. Because what I would have thought about is, you know, drilling holes in the ground. I'm a high technology software architect. I think about very complex systems. You know, drilling holes in the ground with Texans that talk like this and drill holes for oil. Well, that never did become interesting for me and never would. I don't mean to put anybody down who's in the oil business, but they really do talk that way. The thing is, what I didn't understand is why is it that our lives are not like, say, that TV show, Little House on the Prairie, where everybody lives on a farm and, you know, lives off the land and has to fend for themselves. Well, most people would say technology. In reality, it's not just technology. It's technology to use energy. And if peak oil, a thesis that has been discredited by some, but I think that it's a question of time, when we get to the peak cheap oil moment that I think is coming in the next few years, where energy becomes prohibitively expensive, it's going to transform the entire world dramatically. So just figuring out how much time do we have? And it's definitely years. It's not an impending doom thing or anything. But when do we get to the point where the extraction cost of energy to produce crude oil, which is absolutely essential to run the world economy, becomes a constraining factor that prevents economic growth? It's just so fascinating for me to learn about these things. And no, I still don't have much interest in oil wells and how they work. But the effect of energy in the economy is just profoundly interesting to me.
Well, so is that accent, Eric. Well, what about learning from watching television? Cable networks like CNBC and Bloomberg are popular with finance professionals. Now, I have my own sources, but would you say that's a good place to learn how to reinvent yourself as a private investor on a professional level?
Well, maybe in the very beginning. Certainly CNBC and Bloomberg have value in the sense that for news coverage, you know, you want to watch Janet Yellen give a press conference after the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee meeting. They're going to have it on Bloomberg or CNBC. So it's a place to get the news. In the beginning, I found CNBC and Bloomberg very useful just for learning the terminology of finance. You know, I'd turn on CNBC and they'd say, all of a sudden, the market's going crazy, and they're reporting on what happened. Well, there was an unexpected liquidity injection from the Fed, and now experts are warning that as we approach the zero bound, there's a risk of a liquidity trap. And I'm just thinking, a liquidity injection? I'm imagining a doctor with a syringe, you know, injecting something in a patient. I don't know what any of this means.
That's right.
The combination of watching those channels and having Wikipedia at your side to look up, okay, what's a liquidity trap? That actually means when they get to the point where they can't provide any more easing and they can't inject more liquidity. Well, what's a liquidity injection? What do these things mean? In the very beginning, those networks are useful. But what you figure out pretty quickly, and I think one of the most useful things that they're good for, is fairly quickly you should get to the point where you see through what's going on there. You realize the experts that they have on are not really experts. And one of the best known tricks on Wall Street, if there's a guy, say a fund manager, who's got a big position in, let's say, XYZ stock, and he's figured out it was a dumb idea, it's a loser, but he's got so much of it that if he tries to sell it, his own selling activity is going to push the price down and he's going to get a lousy price. So he'll go and volunteer to appear on CNBC or Bloomberg, and they love having these high-profile fund managers, and he'll come on, and the words you want to watch out for is to say, well, one stock that we own is XYZ Corporation, and then he'll go on to tell a lot of story about what XYZ Corporation does and so forth. It sounds like he's recommending it, giving a glowing recommending endorsement. In reality, it's a lie. What he's doing is he's trying to get people listening to want to buy this stock so that there's somebody for him to sell it to because he's trying to get rid of it. So the value in terms of substantive education coming from CNBC and Bloomberg, not really, but in the very beginning they're useful. Now, if you want to learn something from watching television, I have just huge respect for the guys at Real Vision Television. Real Vision is a paid subscription service. You have to pay for it. It's $1 a day, 365 days a year. So it's nothing. but it is long-form interviews, 30 to 45 minutes each, with people who really are fund managers, some of the smartest people in finance, talking on a substantive level about trends they see in where markets are headed and so forth. It has infinitely more value than the cable networks, and at a dollar a day, it's cheap. If you are new to this and you don't have a professional background in finance, because Real Vision is intended for a professional finance audience, you're not going to understand the terminology at first. Don't be put off by that. Again, Wikipedia is your best friend. Watch these interviews. You won't fully understand them, but it will allow you to form questions. And it's an excellent way to learn.
Okay, so hang on. Before anyone takes a wallet out for Real Vision, we should tell them that we have a special relationship with the Real Vision guys for our Macro Voices listeners. You can actually get a free one-week trial of Real Vision using our discount code. Just go to realvisiontv.com/discount/macrovoices, where you can sign up. The trial is completely free of charge, and we don't make anything if you sign up. We just offer this free trial promotion to our listeners as a courtesy to the Real Vision TV guys, because we really believe in what they're doing, and I get a lot of value on a daily basis. So moving on, Eric, what about other resources on the internet? What do you recommend there?
Well, obviously, I'm a little bit biased here, but I fully believe that our Macro Voices podcast is the very best resource that there is. The whole concept behind Macro Voices was I wanted to create a podcast that was specifically intended for high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. And the reason is that I've learned the value of collaborating with other investors. I mentioned starting that roundtable group in Hong Kong with a bunch of hedge fund traders. I really would like to promote the development of a global network of sophisticated, high net worth individuals, family offices, other sophisticated investors who collaborate and share investing ideas online. So the idea is we have a weekly podcast where we interview an expert guest, famous person in the world of finance. That's to get the conversation started. And then there's a listener discussion forum where the listeners to the program can keep the conversation going and discuss it online through a threaded discussion forum. So that's Macro Voices, and that's, you know, my favorite resource. Obviously, it's my project, and it's something that I do out of passion for the idea. We're not selling it. It's totally free of charge, and it's available at macrovoices.com. The next piece of advice I have is set up a separate email account for your finance stuff, and then subscribe to all the free stuff that you can. And there's a lot of really good free stuff out there. Am I going to give you a list of what the best free stuff is? Well, I'd love to, but invoke the Schwager Doctrine. My best free stuff is my stuff. There's a free newsletter I get called Peak Oil News and Peak Oil Review that is a fantastic just daily summary of headlines. It's only interesting if you're interested in crude oil. Maybe you're a fixed income guy and, you know, you want to look at something like Grant's Interest Rate Observer, which is a fantastic paid newsletter. The point is, before you start paying for anything, sign up for a bunch of free things and be smart about what free stuff you spend your time on. Where you're going to allocate your time is more important than how much money you spend. I would say don't make the mistake of saying, oh, I'm not going to waste my time on free newsletters. I can afford to get a good one. Well, some of the free ones are just as good as some of the paid ones, frankly. There is an incredible wealth of information out there. One of the websites I really like is seekingalpha.com. The concept there is anybody can write for them. So you can, again, follow the Schwager Doctrine. Find the people that resonate with your style and follow them. There's a way you can follow authors and get notified when they write a new article. The best way, though, that I know to find free stuff on the internet is our own Macro Voices Research Roundup. The idea here is we basically recruited a team of volunteers who are listeners to our Macro Voices podcast to help us scour the internet and look for the very best articles and other free content every week. We then send out just a very short email, which is a compendium of links to all the best free stuff we could find in a given week. So go to macrovoices.com, register a free account with your email address, and you'll start receiving our weekly Research Roundup email. Every single week, it's going to have a list of links, and a lot of those links will be to websites that offer free subscription services. Have a separate account for that so you don't overwhelm your personal email account, and sign up for lots of free stuff. There's plenty of it out there.
So, Eric, what about professional finance conferences? I mean, many of them offer free admission to high net worth individuals or private investors. Is that a good opportunity for learning?
Not really as much as I thought it was. I went to a bunch of these things in the beginning. I thought, well, I'd go to professional finance conferences and learn about finance on a professional level. What I didn't really understand is that the business model for these conferences is different than what I was used to. I did a lot of public speaking at trade shows in the software business when I was running my software company. So the way that works, at least in my industry, is the featured keynote speaker is going to be a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates, you know, somebody who is the absolute leader of the field. And then the people who are speaking at the various different, you know, talks and conferences that are offered are going to be leaders in their field, the very best software engineers or the best, you know, systems designers or what have you. That's not the way it works in the so-called pay-to-play business model of a lot of these finance conferences. The featured keynote speaker is just the guy who wrote the $50,000 check to purchase the opportunity to be the keynote speaker. He doesn't necessarily know anything. He's a salesman who's there to sell you on whatever his company is selling. Similarly, the other speakers, they're not selected because they're experts in their field. They're selected because they wrote the $10,000 check that was necessary to buy the opportunity to be one of the speakers, or the $3,000 check that was necessary to buy the opportunity to be one of the panelists on a panel. They're there to sell stuff. So going to these conferences can be worthwhile, mostly for the sake of networking and interfacing with other investors. The people that are there to sell stuff usually don't have anything very interesting to sell, but you can go for free. You can be wined and dined. There's one outfit in particular called Opal Group that runs family office events. Family offices are very high net worth families that have actually hired professional investment staff to run their family's finances. So these hired guns are going to these conferences looking for, supposedly looking for hedge funds to invest in. Really, most of the time, they're going to get the free wine and dine experience. I went to one in Napa Valley. It was a wine tasting thing. You know, you go and ride around and taste wine at different wineries and network with other investors. It was fun, but I don't think that you're going to learn a lot there. Now, the really good conferences where the guy that's speaking really is a top guy in the finance industry, those are much harder to get into. They're not free. This is a possible value of those private banking relationships that you heard me talk about in part one of this series, which were really not for me. But, you know, if you want to get into a hard-to-get-into conference, you can call your private banker up and say, hey, get me tickets. I want to go to CLSA in Hong Kong, which is a hard conference to get into. They'll get you a ticket. So that probably is a value of having a private banker, although they're going to want to go with you because they want to make sure that nobody else is trying to sell you anything without them being involved in the deal.
Yeah, that sounds right. Now, before we move on to categories of private investors, Eric, what else do our listeners need to know about the process of educating oneself about markets and investing?
I think the most important thing is to have a realistic plan. And I'm just saying this based on what I saw of other members of the high net worth investor club that I was in. A lot of people told themselves that they were, you know, really going to put out their all into becoming the very best private investor they could. In reality, they came to the meetings and they enjoyed the wine and cheese and didn't really put a lot of effort in. So I think you have to be realistic. Do you really want to put energy and time into learning a new trick? If not, maybe private banking is for you, but just be real careful about which private banker you choose. Maybe the smaller wealth management services are a better choice than the big investment banks. If you're going to do this and you really do want to be a private investor, well, how much time are you realistically going to put into it? Make a plan and make commitments to yourself. And again, I have to revisit the Schwager Doctrine. It's not going to work unless you find something that you personally have passion for. Otherwise, you're going to lose an interest. And so it's a question of just putting the time in to figure out where you find your personal passion.
Okay, Eric, so let's move on to the different categories of private investors and talk about how much work each requires. Now, are we talking about a full-time or a part-time job here?
Certainly doesn't have to be a full-time job. A lot of it is a part-time job. And, you know, the first level of this is what I call the informed private banking client. Private banking wasn't for me, as we discussed in part one, but maybe for other people. I shared with you my friend Larry's advice for how to manage your private bankers. If you wanted to let private bankers run your money for you, or maybe a smaller private wealth management firm, which might be a little bit of a better choice than a big investment bank, okay, think about how you're going to engage them. If I were going to consider that. I would want to have a plan where I'm going to talk to my private bankers at least once a month and have them explain everything that they're doing in my account. What decisions are you making and why are you making them? You might find out that some of these guys, if you don't keep on top of them, just forget about you. And whatever they sold you last time that you were in their office, they're still collecting fees on it, and they don't care whether it's still a smart investment for you to be in. So keep them honest. Stay in touch with them and be an informed user of private banking services. That's probably number one, and that's definitely not a full-time job.
So it sounds like you still need to be proactive. So what's the next step after private banking for investors who maybe want to take a more active role in managing their own investments?
Well, the next level is what I call the asset allocator. And most of the people that were in the club that I was in, this is where they were really at. And what it means is you need to learn about portfolio construction and different asset classes. What's private equity? What's venture capital? What are the different hedge fund strategies? How do these things work? What are all these different investment schemes? Learn about things like allocation percentages, how much to put in different categories, how to diversify your positions, and so forth. But you're not doing any of the trading yourself. What you're doing is researching and interviewing outside managers to run your money for you. So you decide, okay, I want to put 10% of my net worth into private equity. Well, where am I going to find the best private equity manager? Interview a bunch of managers. Now, when you're investing in something like, you know, a mutual fund, obviously the fund manager who has tens of thousands of investors doesn't have time to meet with you personally. Most of these alternative investments, if we're talking about hedge funds, private equity, venture capital funds, the investment manager, the fund manager, will meet with you as a high net worth individual if you're talking about investing millions of dollars into their fund. And it's worth doing that to interview them and really figure out who the best guy is. So you're allocating capital to outside managers, and your job is to think about things like correlations. Okay, if I've got a 10% in private equity, well, what is not correlated to private equity that would be the next thing to put some of my other assets into, so that if something goes wrong in the private equity market, I won't be exposed to it in the rest of my portfolio. So it's about portfolio construction. It's also about learning about estate planning, you know, wills and trusts and all that kind of stuff, which tends to be very important, especially in large families that are high net worth. And you have to have a commitment to learning. And I'd say the best way to achieve that learning obligation is probably to start at least by joining one of these clubs. IPI that we mentioned earlier, the Institute for Private Investors, is probably well suited. Now, again, I've never been in that particular organization. I can't speak to it firsthand. People I know that are members speak very highly of it. Being an asset allocator definitely does not need to be a full-time job. You could do that several days a month of just researching investments and designing your strategy, interfacing and networking with other private investors, looking for good opportunities to add to your portfolio. And a benefit of this approach, especially if you're semi-retired after, you know, finishing running your business or something, is you can put as much or as little time into it as you want. Once you've designed a portfolio and hired outside managers, you can kind of leave it status quo, or you can very actively engage yourself in staying in touch with those managers and keeping in touch with what they're doing and looking for better investments and interfacing with other investors. So it allows you to throttle your degree of commitment up or down based on the amount of time that you have available.
Okay, but if the primary job of an asset allocator or private investor is to interview and hire managers to run different parts of their portfolio, where do you find the candidate managers to begin with?
Well, that is the hard part, because for all these alternative investments that are only available to accredited investors, they're not allowed to advertise openly. So you've got to know where to find them. Now, the industry's answer to that question is, oh, there are these guys called capital introduction brokers, or cap intro is the catchword in the business. Mm-hmm. What I want you to understand about cap intro guys is these are the people who got Bernie Madoff to where he was before he was found out to be a complete and total fraud.
Oh boy.
Their sales pitch is, look, you are going to invest in hedge funds or private equity. You need professionals on your side. You need a team of professionals that will do exhaustive due diligence and find only the best of the best, the most reputable and honest and trustworthy investment managers. And we are going to introduce them to you, and we'll do it apparently free of charge. Now, of course, they're getting a kickback from the funds that they introduce you to. And what made Bernie Madoff so successful is he knew how to play play this game. He paid these guys even more than their asking price, which is traditionally about 20% of the fees that the manager makes from you. Bernie Madoff voluntarily gave them 25 or more because he wanted to be their favorite. And they can be bought off very easily. And as far as they're doing exhaustive due diligence research and making sure that there's no fraud, it's a bunch of BS. These guys are brokers who are there like a dating service to make a buck on an introduction. I don't trust them, frankly. So you don't really want to go with them, in my opinion. There may be some small private wealth management shops that you know you can deal with that will help introduce you to the good guys. But I think you're better off, frankly, doing this more by something like an organization like IPI, interfacing with and networking with more experienced private investors, getting their advice. There are fund databases. Be careful, though, because what a lot of people do is they'll go to these online fund databases. One of them was hedgefund.net. I think they've been acquired now by Marhedge. You go online and you think, oh, well, I'll just sort them by best return first. Well, wait a minute. If you're going to search for the guy who's got a 250% annual return, you're going to find the fraudsters before you find anybody else. So you really need to think in terms of finding the highest quality managers, not the guy who has the highest return last year. That's probably more of a yellow flag than it is an indication of the best manager. You have to learn how to conduct a due diligence review and really check these guys out because, you know, you are dealing in an unregulated world where some of the protections that are available to retail investors have, you know, been turned off because you are a rich guy and you don't need it, according to the SEC. So an organization like IPI is probably a good way to start. And the online databases are definitely the way to search for funds, but you have to learn a bit about these investment funds first. And I would say that be careful of anything which is, you know, the book you can buy that's the guide to the very best hedge funds, only the award-winning hedge funds. This is a racket. I get an email every other day that tells me my company, Fourth Turning Capital Management, has just been nominated as the asset manager of the year. And we have several programs. If you would like to, as a nominee, be the Grand Poobah Asset Manager of the Year, well, that's $50,000. And if you want to spend $25,000, you can get the runner-up prize, or you can be one of the Sector Managers of the Year for $10,000. The fund pays a bit, what's essentially an advertising fee in order to win this award. So watch out for any guide to the very best hedge funds or private equity funds or whatever. They tend to be paid advertising under disguise.
Yeah, that definitely sounds dodgy. So at some point, you decide to make this a full-time job and to start doing some of the trading yourself. So Eric, what caused you to make that transition? And when do you think it's advisable for others to maybe do the same?
Well, finding passion is the absolute center of this. You don't want to be trading the money yourself unless you are passionate about what you're doing. You don't want to dabble in this. So you need two things, passion and edge. You need to know why you're not just randomly trading. What is your edge over other traders? What is it that you've figured out that you really know more about? Definitely, if you're going to consider this, you have to read all four of Jack Schwager's Market Wizards books at least once. Figure out what style works for you, where you have the passion, where you can develop the edge. And my rule of thumb is you should never consider trading more than 10% of your net worth yourself unless you're willing to do it full time. If you can do what I do and put 100% full-time commitment, just like you did when you were running your whatever business got you to this point, great. Then learn to run the money yourself. I found it to be extremely rewarding personally, not just in terms of the investment returns, but it's the most exciting, interesting job that I've ever had. It's way more fun than running a software company. But if you're not going to do it full time, don't dabble with this. Be an asset allocator. Hire somebody else to run your money for you because it's a competitive game. You've got to pick something to be really, really good at. And if you're just dabbling with it part time, you're not going to have edge. You're going to end up losing that way. Doing a little bit of everything is a really bad plan. Your portfolio needs to be diversified. Your portfolio needs exposure to a little bit of everything. So you don't want to be running all of your money yourself. You want to figure out where your passion is, where you have edge, and you want to put your asset allocator hat on and say, okay, I'm considering hiring myself to run a portion of my portfolio. Well, how much experience do I have at this so far? That should be the first question you ask in terms of how much of your own portfolio you're willing to allocate to yourself. Start small. You probably lose money at first. Almost all traders do. Eventually, when you get good at it and have a proven track record, now maybe you're going to allocate more of your net worth to yourself rather than to outside managers. But again, do it with 100% commitment of time and energy, or do it with less than 10% of your assets. It's not going to work unless you have both passion and edge.
So passion, edge, commitment, and focus. Got it, Eric. So these days you run a hedge fund yourself. Was that always your goal when you reinvented yourself as a full-time investor?
No, quite the opposite. I wanted absolutely nothing to do with this industry because I don't like the culture, at least on the sell side of it. It turns out in what I'm doing, running a small fund, I'm not exposed to those guys, and I do have the opportunity to talk to other fund managers, and it's very rewarding. But I would say to anyone, don't assume that you're never going to want to do this. A lot of people assume, well, I don't see myself ever, you know, in a second career in finance. I can't imagine how that would ever make sense for me. I certainly thought that when I began this journey in 2006. Here's what can happen. Let's suppose you're going to be an asset allocator and you get really good at investing in hedge funds. You learn how to pick the winners, interview the managers, do the due diligence, and you're investing in hedge funds and you're doing really well at it. Well, there's this other idea called a fund of funds. That's a fund that manages assets for people by investing them in hedge funds or in other types of alternative investment funds. This doesn't necessarily have to be about making more fees for yourself. Suppose that you're that asset allocator guy and you've figured out that the very best hedge funds all have huge minimum investments, some of them $5 or $10 million minimum. If you're going to be well diversified, so you've only got 10% of your assets in one fund, that means you've got to be running at least $50 to $100 million before you can even consider those really good funds. Well, if you start doing this for other people by running a fund of funds, you're doing the same thing. You're getting the opportunity now to get into other funds or larger funds that you wouldn't have had the opportunity to with your own assets, because now you're managing a much larger total amount of assets under management. And it also means that you can negotiate a little bit with these guys and potentially get a discount on your fees. If you're not using a capital introduction broker, maybe you can get a discount on the fees and you don't even need to charge your investors a separate level of fees, because you're able to make a little bit just by getting the fund managers to give you a discount. So there's lots of reasons to do this. And I've met several people who started as private investors who were asset allocators, had no intention of ever being in the business. And once they got good at it, they said, boy, running a fund of funds is really doing the same job I'm already doing, but I could do it for other people. I'd be running more money and I'd be compensated for it. Why not? That's a great idea. And frankly, you also end up, you know, your investors become, you know, they're very interesting people. They're high net worth individuals like you, and they're fascinating people to get to know. So it can add a lot of positive value to your life, completely independent of what fees it might generate.
And what about you personally? You're not running a fund of funds. You're actually running a hedge fund, and you do all the trading yourself, right, Eric? What motivated you to transition from trading your own account as a private investor to allowing other accredited investors to invest alongside you through a hedge fund structure?
Well, it started really, you know, I was an asset allocator. I was investing in hedge funds in the beginning. And once I really developed the passion for macroeconomics and wanting to understand the world through the lens of the economy and markets, I had to do it myself. And I didn't want to invest in funds anymore. I wanted to manage my own money. So I was a private investor running my own accounts. I was networking with hedge fund guys because they were the best people to network with in order to learn more about this and share trading ideas. And what my friend said to me is, you know, you ought to just turn this thing into a hedge fund. You're doing all the work already. And I resisted that at first. When I eventually launched a fund in 2013, I did it because I felt like I would like to be able to do more research about the future of energy markets. I'd love to be able to hire a research staff. I'm never going to be able to do that with just running my own money. Maybe I do want to do this. And it's actually been a hugely positive thing in my life for a whole bunch of ways that I never anticipated. The idea of making fees by getting a commission out of running other people's money, sure, that's nice. It allows me to pay for producing the Macro Voices podcast, for example. But that's not my primary motivation. My investment returns have improved markedly since I've been doing this in a fund. And I think the reason is I have a purpose again. I'm not just a guy investing his own money. I'm running a business. I take it very seriously. I apply myself very hard to it. And the discipline that I have added to my own life because I'm doing this as a business now has improved my investing performance. It also allows me to pay for research and tools that I wouldn't otherwise have. You know, the Macro Voices podcast is one example. I produce that. It allows me to interview the smartest people in the business, people who would never take my call otherwise, and I get to pick their brains for an hour every week, talking to the smartest people on the planet, asking them all my personal questions under the auspices of doing it in a podcast that other people can listen to. That's right. it's very rewarding, and there's a lot of personal value, as I mentioned, in the client network. There's a lot of really cool, interesting people, and they're motivated to help. You know, if you've got, let's say, you were running your experience is in electrical engineering and you're running an electrical engineering fund and your investors are electrical engineers. When you're trying to assess a company and figure out if they're any good, your investors know a lot about this. They can help you. And that network of people can be very beneficial and useful to you.
Great. So let's summarize the key points we've discussed so far. One, start with a plan to learn about markets and investing on a professional level, and commit yourself to a realistic plan of continuous learning. And second, embrace the Schwager doctrine. Figure out what works for you and understand your own personality. And third, if you're ready to become an asset allocator, get help from an organization like IPI. Fourth, don't run any significant percentage of your assets yourself unless you're willing to commit to doing it full-time. And don't do that until you first find your own passion and edge. And finally, don't rule out being a fund of fund or even fund manager someday. And understand there are plenty of motivations for doing so other than earning fees from other investors. Before we close, please tell our listeners what's coming up in parts 3 and 4.
Well, part 3 is all about private equity, which begins with angel investing, which means helping other entrepreneurs to launch their businesses by providing both the seed capital and the expertise of having perhaps already had the experience of running your own business. We move from there into venture capital, which is later stage investing. There are opportunities for entrepreneurs to participate actively in venture capital investments, private equity funds, which invest in things like leverage buyouts and so forth. So we're going to talk about that whole category called private equity in part 3. Then part 4 is all about hedge funds and fund of funds. What are hedge funds? How do they work? What are the different hedge fund investment strategies? So on and so forth. We're going to cover that topic in gory detail in part 4, all of which are available free of charge at macrovoices.com.
So thanks for joining us, everybody. And please check out Macro Voices, the weekly podcast Eric and I co-host. Eric interviews the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics each week after we do our own review of the week's market action. Macro Voices is always free of charge at macrovoices.com, or you can subscribe for free in iTunes to have the show delivered to your mobile device each week automatically. You can also register a free account at macrovoices.com with your email address, and you'll then receive our free weekly research roundup email, which is a compendium of the best free research our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You can also find all 4 parts of this special series for accredited investors, all free at macrovoices.com. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan, wishing all of you the very best in your own personal journey to find what style of private investing best suits for your own personality and lifestyle.
And just a reminder, folks, you've heard the aforementioned references to parts 3 and 4 because we're planning that someday. They're not really there at macrovoices.com yet. We said that because we're saving this audio for someday when they are. Again, episode 1 was available in Macro Voices episode Alpha, which aired on July 7th. This was episode 2. 3 and 4 are coming someday. Please let us know through the listener discussion forums what you thought. We're still trying to decide whether there's even a market for parts 3 and 4.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.